Chapter 23. The punch sank deep into Max's stomach, doubling him over as much as the ropes holding him to the chair would allow. Zelimir Kovach hadn't used half of his tremendous strength, and Hanley felt as though his guts had been turned to jelly. He grunted at the pain, spraying saliva and blood from his ruined mouth. It was the fourth consecutive body blow, and he hadn't expected it. Blindfolded, he could only rely on his torturer's natural rhythm to anticipate the blow, and so far Kovach hadn't established one. His punches were as random as they were brutal. He'd been at it for 10 minutes and hadn't yet asked a single question. The duct tape covering Max's eyes was suddenly ripped away, taking with it some of his heavy brows. The sensation was like having acid splashed on his face, and he couldn't contain the yowl that burst from his lips. He looked around, blinking through the gush of tears. The room was bare and antiseptic, with white cinder block walls and a concrete floor. Ominously, there was a drain in the floor at Max's feet and a water spigot with a length of hose coiled on a peg next to the metal door. The door was open, and beyond, Max could see the hallway had the same block walls and shabby white paint. Kovach stood over Max, wearing suit trousers and a sleeveless undershirt. The Serb's sweat and Max's blood stained the shirt's cotton. A pair of guards in matching jumpsuits leaned against the wall, their faces stony. Kovach thrust a hand toward one of the guards, and the man handed him a sheaf of papers. "According to your son," Kovach began, "your name is Max Hanley, and you are part of the Merchant Marine, a ship's engineer. Is this correct?" "Go to hell," Max said in a low, menacing tone. Kovach squeezed a nerve bundle at the base of Max's neck, sending torrents of pain lancing to every part of his body. He kept up the pressure, squeezing even harder until Max was literally panting. "Is that information correct?"
"Yes, damn it," Max said through clenched teeth.
Kovach released his grip and slammed his fist into Max's jaw hard enough to twist his head.
"That's for lying. You had a transdermal transponder embedded in your leg. That isn't common for the Merchant Marines."
"The company I hired to get Kyle back," Max mumbled, wishing more than anything to be able to massage some feeling into his face where it had gone numb. "They implanted it as part of their security."
Kovach punched Max in the face again, loosening a tooth.
"Nice try. But the scar was at least 6 months old."
It was a good guess. Hux had implanted his new one 7 months ago.
"It's not. I swear it," Max lied. "That's how I heal, fast and ugly. Look at my hands."
Kovach glanced down. Hanley's hands were a patchwork of old crisscrossed scars. It meant nothing to him. He leaned in so his face was inches from Max's.
"I have inflicted more scars in my life than a surgeon and know how people heal. That implant is 6 or more months old. Tell me who you are and why have you such a device?"
Max's response was to slam the crown of his balding head into Kovach's nose. The restraint binding him to the chair prevented him from breaking the bone, but he was satisfied with the jet of blood that flew from one nostril until the Serb staunched it with his fingers. The look Kovach shot Hanley was one of pure animal rage. Max had known the strike was going to earn him the beating of his life, but as Kovach glared, smears of blood like war paint on his face, Max felt certain he had gone too far. The blows came in a flurry. There was no pattern, no aim. It was an explosive reaction, the instinct of the primeval hindbrain toward a perceived threat. Max took shots to the face, chest, stomach, shoulders, and groin in a rain of punches and kicks that seemed inexhaustible. The strikes came so fast, he felt certain more than one person was hitting him, but as his eyes rolled back so that only the whites showed, he could tell the punishment was being meted out by Kovach alone. 2 full minutes passed after Max had slumped over in his chair, his face a pulped mass, until one of the guards finally stepped in to restrain the Serb butcher. Kovac turned his murderous gaze at the interruption, and the guard hastily backed away, but the distraction was enough to cool his rage. He looked contemptuously at Hanley's unconscious form, his chest heaving with exertion and adrenaline. Kovac snapped his wrists, making the taxed joints pop audibly and sending droplets of their mingled blood to the floor. Reaching over, he pushed up Max's right eyelid. All that showed was a veined white orb. Kovac turned to the guards.
"Come back and check on him in a couple of hours. If he doesn't break next time, we will have his son flown here from Corinth and see how much of a beating he can watch the kid take before he tells us what we want to know."
He strode out the open door. The two guards waited a moment and then followed, closing the heavy door behind them. They never looked back or felt movement in the room because it was the last thing they would have expected. Watching them leave through nearly closed eyes, Max was in motion the instant their backs turned. All throughout the terrible pounding, he had worked his body back and forth in the chair to loosen the ropes. Kovac's fury had blinded him to this, and the guards had assumed Hanley's jerky movements were in response to the blows. But Max's actions had been cold and deliberate. He bent over and grabbed one of the pieces of paper Kovac had tossed aside when Max had hit his nose. Shuffling with the metal chair strapped to his back, he lunged toward the door. He had one shot at this because even if he survived another beating, he would tell them whatever they needed to know to protect Kyle no matter the consequences. His aim was perfect. The piece of paper slipped between the door and the jamb the instant before the lock engaged, preventing the bolt from sliding home. Max sagged back into the chair. It had been the worst pounding he had ever taken. Even more savage than when he was in a Viet Cong prison, and there they had taken turns so that the blows went on for an hour or more. He felt around his mouth, moving 2 teeth freely with his tongue. It had been a minor miracle that his nose hadn't broken or one of the body blows hadn't caused his heart to fibrillate and stop. The spot where they had cut out the bioelectric transponder was a dull ache compared to the rest of his body. His chest was a mottled sea of bruised flesh, and he could only imagine the damage done to his face.
"Well, I wasn't all that pretty to begin with," he thought grimly, and the wry smile that followed brought fresh blood from the cuts on his lips.
Max promised himself 10 minutes to recover. Any longer and he would have cramped up to the point of immobility. There was a glimmer of hope amid his pain. At least they hadn't brought Kyle to this hellhole. He was back in Greece. Even in the responsivist's grasp, he was relatively safe. Max clutched that thought to his heart and let it buoy his spirits. By his estimation, 6 minutes had passed when he started working on the loosened ropes. He had created enough slack to work his wrists free of them so he could use his hands to pull away the ropes wound around his chest. Finally, he was able to untie his legs and stand. He groped for the back of the chair to keep from toppling over.
"I don't feel so good," he muttered aloud and waited for his blurred vision to clear.
He eased open the heavy door as quietly as he could. The hallway was empty. The industrial fluorescent fixtures bolted to the concrete ceiling cast stark pools of light interspersed with deep shadows, giving the cinder block walls a dingy look despite their apparent newness. Max balled the piece of paper into the lock so the door wouldn't close, and keeping in a low crouch because his muscles wouldn't let him stand upright, he padded down the hallway, making certain he wasn't leaving a telltale trail of blood. At the first intersection, he heard faint, muffled voices to his left, so he turned right, casting an eye backward every few seconds. He passed an occasional unlabeled door. Pressing an ear to the cool metal, he heard nothing beyond and moved on. It was the dankness of the air and the fact he'd seen no windows that made him think he was underground. He had no direct proof, but didn't doubt his assessment. Turning two more times in the monochromatic maze, he came to another door and could hear the whine of machinery inside. He tried the handle, and it turned easily. He opened it a crack, and the level of noise rose in timbre and volume. He could see no light escaping from the room, so he assumed it was deserted. He ducked in quickly and closed the door behind him. Groping blindly, he found a light switch. Arc lights snapped on, revealing a cavernous space sunk below the level of the floor he was standing on. He was in the control room overlooking the facility's powerhouse. Behind thick, insulated glass were four huge jet engines bolted to the floor, fed by a tangle of fuel lines and exhaust ducts. Mated to each was an electrical generator. The assemblies were slightly larger than a locomotive, and although only one of the turbines was in operation, the room buzzed and crackled with undisguised power. "Either this place is massive," Max thought, casting an expert eye over the room again, "because they can produce enough juice for a couple thousand people, or they have some other unknown use for this much electricity." He mentally filed away the incongruity and retreated back into the hallway. With no visible cameras and no guards patrolling the corridors, Max had a sense that Kovach must feel pretty secure here. It was another fact that he tucked away as he sought an exit from the labyrinth. He finally came to a door marked stairwell, but when he opened it, he discovered the stairs led only downward. "In for a penny, in for a pound," he muttered, and headed deeper into the facility. The scissor-style stairs zigzagged four stories before coming to an end on a dimly lit landing. The only door led into an even darker tunnel that ran perpendicular to the stairwell. Unlike the other areas Max had seen, the perfectly circular tunnel was of rough-hewn native rock and was just large enough for him to stand. He could see where some sort of machine, like a continuous miner or a tunnel borer, had left ragged tool marks on the dark stone. There were no lights, so he had no way of knowing how long the tunnel was or what it was for. The only clues were thick copper wires strung along the ceiling from ceramic insulators. There had to have been 100 of them, each carefully spaced from its neighbor. His engineering background told him they could easily take the electrical load of the generators he'd seen on the upper level. "What are you supposed to do, my beauty?" he mused aloud. But of course, there was no answer. He considered following the wire, blindly hoping it led to an exit, but the stillness of the air made him think that the tunnel had no outlet. He also hadn't forgotten he was at least 50 feet underground, possibly more. Max set himself the arduous task of climbing the stairs. His body protested every step, and as the exertion deepened his breathing, it felt like a vice was clamped around his chest. Even if his ribs weren't fully broken, he laid a silent wager that a couple of them sported hairline cracks. He was panting when he reached the upper landing and had to clamp his elbows to the sides of his chest to ease away some of the pain. Pressing his ear to the door, he heard muffled voices, and as they faded, he thought he heard one person say to another, "Sky 2 days from now, so we'll need..." He waited another few moments before opening the door. The hallway was deserted. He couldn't even hear the echo of their footfalls. Padding silently, he renewed his search for a way out. He was halfway down one long hallway when he heard people approaching. Their movements were swift and sure, making him think it might be Kovach and his goons heading back to his cell for another go at him, although only a half hour had passed since they had left him. Knowing he couldn't run even if he wanted to, Max had no choice but to duck through one of the metal doors lining the corridor. He held the knob open as he closed the door so the lock couldn't engage and stood pressed against it as the footfalls drew nearer. It was only after they strode past that Max glanced over his shoulder at the darkened room. By the glow of a small light plugged into an outlet, he saw 6 cots laid out in rows and the obvious outline of 6 people asleep on top of them. One person must have been the lightest sleeper in the world because he suddenly grunted and shot bolt upright, peering myopically into the gloom. "Steve?" he called out. "Yes," Max answered at once. "Go back to sleep." The youngish man fell back onto his cot and rolled away from Max, his breathing relaxing in an instant. Max couldn't say the same about his own breathing. He felt certain his heart was going to hammer through his ribs at any moment, although he was grateful for the anesthetic effects of the adrenaline jolt his near discovery had sent into his veins. He gave it a few more moments before sliding back out of the dormitory room. In all, Max skulked around for nearly an hour before finding a stairwell that led upward, confirming his suspicions that this was a subterranean base of some kind. Depending on the sizes of the rooms he hadn't explored, he estimated the facility was at least 100,000 square feet. As to its purpose, he could only guess. He climbed two stories before coming to yet another door. He waited with his ear pressed to the metal. He heard sounds from the other side but was unable to identify anything. He eased the door open a crack, pressing his eye to the narrow slit. He saw a wedge of what looked like a garage. The metal trestle roof lofted 20 feet or more, and there was a ramp that led to a pair of industrial-sized garage doors. Embedded in the rock walls next to them were thick steel blast doors that could be swung closed. They looked impregnable to nothing less than a nuclear bomb. Max heard a radio playing some music that, to him, sounded like cats fighting in a burlap bag, but was doubtlessly something Mark Murphy had on his iPod. He saw nobody, so he quickly dashed through the door and found shelter under a wooden workbench littered with greasy tools. Just as the door snicked closed, he realized with horror that it had a sophisticated electronic lock mechanism activated by a palm reader as well as a numeric keypad. There was no returning to his cell and hoping he could talk his way out of another beating. Although the garage was dimly lit, there was a pool of light on the far side where two mechanics were working on a four-wheel drive pickup. From the looks of it, they were replacing the radiator and doing some welding near the front of the vehicle. He could see the blue glow of an oxyacetylene torch and smelled the tang of seared metal. There were other vehicles parked in the garage. He spotted two larger trucks and several four-wheelers, like the one Juan had used to escape the responsivists in Greece. Max felt time slipping by and wished Cabrillo was with him now. Juan had an innate ability to form and execute a plan with the barest glance at the situation. Max, on the other hand, was more of a plotter, attacking a problem with brute force and dogged determination. Kovach would be returning to the interrogation chamber shortly, and Hanley needed to get as far away from this place as he possibly could. Moving cautiously, he realized the garage doors were the only exit and was certain the radio wouldn't mask the sound of one of them rattling open. There was really only one avenue open to him. Brute force it is, he thought. The wrench he grabbed was at least 18 inches long and weighed 10 pounds. He hefted it like a surgeon taking up a scalpel, fully knowing his capabilities with the instrument. He had gotten into his first real fight as a teenager when a strung-out junkie brandishing a knife had tried to rob his uncle's gas station. Max had knocked out 8 of the would-be thief's teeth with a wrench identical to the one he carried now. He moved cautiously across the garage, finding cover where he could and stalking slowly because the human eye's peripheral vision is adept at picking up movement. Any sound he made was drowned out by the radio. One of the mechanics had his face covered by a darkened welder's shield to protect his eyes, so Max concentrated on the second, a tall, lanky man in his 30s with a bushy beard and greasy hair tied in a ponytail. He was bent over the engine compartment, running his hands over a bundle of hoses, so he never felt Max's presence behind him until Max brought the wrench down with a measured swing. The blow dropped the mechanic as if he'd been pole-axed, and the egg it left on his skull would last him weeks. Max turned. The welder had sensed motion and was just straightening, reaching to pull off his mask when Hanley stepped forward and, like a batter in the All-Star game, swung the wrench. At the perfect moment in his swing, Max let the wrench fly. The case-hardened tool smashed the plastic visor, which saved the welder from having his face torn off, while the power of the throw tossed the man bodily into a nearby rolling toolbox. The blowtorch, on its long rubber lines, dropped at Max's feet, the blue jet flame making him step back when he felt the heat on his bare feet. A third mechanic who had been hidden on the far side of the truck suddenly appeared around the front bumper, drawn by the commotion. He stared at the unconscious welder sprawled against the toolbox before turning toward Max. Max watched as confusion became understanding and then anger, but before the man could give in to his fight-or-flight reflex, Max scooped up the still-burning torch and tossed it in an easy underarm throw. Another instinct took over, and the mechanic automatically grabbed for it as it came at him. At over 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit, the tongue of burning oxygen and acetylene needed the briefest contact to char flesh. The mechanic caught the torch with the nozzle pointed directly at his chest. A smoldering hole opened in his overalls instantly, and skin and muscle sizzled away to reveal the white of his rib cage. The bones blackened before the massive load of shock made him drop the brass torch. His expression didn't change in the seconds it took his brain to realize his heart had stopped beating. He collapsed slowly to the concrete floor. The smell made Max want to retch. He hadn't intended to kill the hapless mechanic, but he steeled himself. He had to save his son, and unfortunately, this man stood in his way. The welder was the closest to his size, so he took a moment to strip him out of his coveralls. He had to take the third mechanic's boots because the others were hopelessly small. He did so without looking up from the man's feet. With a pair of wire cutters, he moved to the two trucks and opened the hoods, cutting the wires that sprouted from the distributor caps like black tentacles. As he started for the quad bikes, he saw a coffee machine set up on a workbench. Apart from filters, mugs, and a plastic container of creamer powder, there was a box of sugar. Max grabbed it, and rather than waste time messing with the Kawasaki's electronics, he unscrewed their fuel caps and dumped sugar into their tanks. The bikes wouldn't run for more than a quarter mile, and it would take hours to clean out their fuel lines and cylinders. A minute later, he was astride the one idling four-wheeler he hadn't tampered with and pressed the button that opened the garage door. It was night, and wind-ripped rain lashed through the opening. Max couldn't have asked for better conditions. There was no point closing the door. Kovach would know he was gone and how he was making his escape. Slitting his eyes against the rain, he twisted the throttle and shot out into the unknown.